Good morning. The meeting will come to order. Welcome to Education Innovation 2015-16. It's good to see all of you. I wish I had a few more members, but welcome everyone anyway. There are refreshments in the back of the entrance over here to my right. I will take a short recess very shortly so you can get coffee. There is also some fruit, some scones, some donuts, some cheese, so please help yourself. It was fun to shop at Lund's last night and to get ready for this. I love to entertain, you can probably tell, so it's fun to welcome all of you with some refreshments as well. I would like the CLA, Ethan, to note the roll. And a quorum is present, correct? Thank you. What we're going to do this morning is have introductions, and we'll do that after I call a brief recess now. So if anyone wants to get refreshments, you do so. And I'm talking about members, those in the audience, you can get refreshments at any time. But if there are members who would like to get refreshments, I'm going to call like a 5-minute recess. So we're in recess. Please get your refreshments.
Well, other than sitting in traffic, I don't know how I don't like being nice.
We need
question for you right away. If I would have to get pulled out to somebody quitting this thing.
Yes. Is she?
Carlos is here, so.
I'm going to reconvene our meeting, but please feel free to help yourself to refreshments. That includes those in the audience. Members seem to be on diets this morning, so please, I'd like to have the food gone so I don't have to take it all back to my office. So get up anytime from your seats and take advantage of that. Again, welcome. Our schedule today really is to focus on No Child Left Behind. Lisa Larson, our nonpartisan House researcher and staff, has prepared a PowerPoint for us. So we will want to get to that shortly. But before we begin introductions of committee members, I would like to recognize FFAers who are in the audience. So would you please stand and give your names and the school program that you represent? And you're going to have to speak loudly. And are you officers? Is that why you're visiting us or not?
Anyone from our chapter was able to come visit. A lot of us are officers in our chapter.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Let's give them a round of applause. Okay, now it's time to meet our members. As you probably know, I'm Sandra Erickson, and I represent a district northwest of here in rural Minnesota. It's labeled 15A. It would include school districts of Princeton, Malacca, Onamia, Isle, Ogilvie, and of course I have students who attend the Elk River District, the Foley District, the Aiken District. Open enrollment takes them many places, Mora included. My goal this session is to try to concentrate on returning control to our locals, more control than we've given them in the past, and to provide minimal changes to our school districts so that there's some stability and to bring about a little bit of innovation, which we know we've worked on in the past. So based on my introduction, I'm going to call on Arena Moran first, and please give your name and your district, your school districts, and maybe, if you'd like, one of your goals this session. Thank you, Rena.
Okay, good morning, and thank you for the coffee and starting my day off.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. My name is Rena Moran. I represent District 65A from St. Paul. Those are the communities of the historical Rondo community, Summit U, the Midway area, Frogtown, and also the District of the Promised Neighborhoods, which would be Maxfield School, Jackson Elementary, and St. Paul City School. I think my goal today, this is a good start in talking about No Child Left Behind, because my goal and my hope was that no child will be left behind.
Joanne?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, and thank you for starting us off with such hospitality. Nice warm welcome. Thank you. I'm Joanne Ward. I represent District 53A, which is South Oakdale, South Maplewood, northwest part of Woodbury, all of Landfall. And I have District 622 and 833, South Washington County, and Oakdale, North St. Paul, Maplewood. And my goals really are focused on early childhood nutrition, and all children succeeding in some area that I have worked on in the past and would like to see more work done on is in youth intervention programs and restorative justice as a way of making schools whole, safe places for kids.
Barb?
Good morning. I'm Barb Yaruso. I represent District 42A, which is all of Moundsview, all of Arden Hills, about two-thirds of Shoreview, and a very, very small piece of Spring Lake Park. That is almost entirely the Moundsview School District, and I have one neighborhood in Arden Hills. It's in the Roseville School District. And in Spring Lake Park, there's only a few families. Some of them may go to Spring Lake Park High schools and some to Monsieur schools. And some of my goals include continuing the work we did on the world's best workforce, preparing students for college and for work, and in particular finding ways to extend ideas that have succeeded in some of our districts. Notably, we've got some great examples in our district to help districts find ways to reach all of their kids.
Yvonne?
I'm Yvonne Seltzer, and I represent Southern Minnetonka and Northern Eden Prairie, which encompasses the Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, and Hopkins school districts. And I am a former teacher and school board chair, so I share your penchant for local control. And I'm also very interested in making sure that the P20 partnership stays alive. I think that the work being done, we have an important role to play here as far as policy to bridge that gap to post-secondary. And then also a bit more specifically, I'm interested, I authored the study last year that looked at combining our QComp and our new teacher evaluation system, and I'd like to see that streamlined and made useful and brought to fruition.
Mr. Chair?
Well, Madam Chair, and members, thank you for the very kind welcome with both food and your personal acknowledgement. I look forward to our meeting later this afternoon. Some of you may not know that Representative Aronson and I have been playing ping pong with chair position for this committee for the past, 6-8 years.
That's why I call him Mr. Chair, because we just go back and forth.
Let me just say that generally I just look forward to serving with you and serving on this committee, which is my favorite committee. I'm a policy wonk kind of person. I'm a politician because I have to be, like most of us, I suspect. But I really think that the true power of the work that we're asked to do resides in our ability to shape consensus in our society. And as important as appropriations are, that's not how you do it. You shape consensus by working on the issues that most affect our constituents. And you look for ways in which our government can be present in a helpful way. And there aren't very many things more important for our constituents than being able to serve our young people and help them become intelligent, knowledgeable human beings and great citizens of our great society. So that's my general philosophy. And with that, my goal really has to do with doing what I can do this year to strengthen this important committee, to assert the primacy of education policy in our state as something that is first and foremost in the minds of all lawmakers, hopefully to keep our partisan differences to a minimum. Madam Chair, you and I have certainly banged heads over the years, but we've also found a lot of common ground. And I think it's because we are motivated by the same philosophy. So I look forward to working with you and with all members of this committee.
Peggy?
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, and for the wonderful treats also. I'm Peggy Bennett. I am from Albert Lea, Minnesota, obviously Minnesota. I'm a teacher currently on leave of absence. I've taught for 33 years. I will be retiring from teaching, though, this next month. I've mostly taught first grade. This is in the Albert Lea area schools, but also have taught special ed, third grade, and kindergarten. And I love teaching. It's just been a passion of mine for many, many years. The school districts I work with are Albert Lea area schools would be the largest district, but I also have a number of other school districts in Glenville, Alden, Wells, Blooming Prairie, and Hayfield. And I've been slowly introducing myself to those other districts as well. So what are my goals? I guess one, as a teacher, I have found myself in the last number of years greatly frustrated with finding time to teach my students because of all the paperwork that comes down onto teachers, and I would like to see teachers freed up more to be able to actually teach. That's obviously our job. So one of my goals would be to help streamline paperwork, and I'm also a firm believer in local control because I think we know best in our districts, you know, what to do with our students. So I would like to see some freedom for teachers and districts in that as well. Thank you.
Ron, Krisha?
And thank you, Madam Chair. And again, thank you for the warm welcome. The early morning coffee was wonderful. So my background is I started in education, and I have taught in as small of a classroom as 30, and that's the whole class, as well as all the way up into some of the larger school districts of Little Falls and the size of Brainerd. So I understand the span of what education can be. Because of that, I have seen all the different things that schools try to accomplish, and more importantly, that teachers try to accomplish to reach their kids. And as I look at that, I have come to recognize the strong importance of early learning, as well as avoiding the adverse childhood experiences that we've all heard about, and how those can really put a kid behind before they even have a chance to put their name on a paper. And so as I look at that, my goal is really to make sure that we limit those liabilities for those kids before they get to the school, and that we empower the educators and the innovators. And Representative Bennett hit it right in the head. When I was a teacher, one of our common phrases was that the suits in St. Paul should just leave us alone. Well, by my appearance today, I'm one of those suits in St. Paul. And I don't forget my roots, and I think back to those days, and I think every day that I sit in committee, there's a teacher sitting there trying to reach some kid who came to school hungry, or doesn't know if his parents are going to be around when he gets home, or if when she gets home, she's going to have someone there to help her with homework. And so those are all realities that I have been through, that many of us have seen as well, and we need to recognize that. We need to remember that what we do here is vastly important, but it can't take away from those efforts that are happening in the classroom. And the other thing that I have learned in being in Chair Mariani's committee last year, as well as some of the things we're trying to accomplish this year, is the diverse geographic nature of our schools. The fact that Ivanhoe, Minnesota is trying to do things that Minnetonka can't do, and vice versa. And we have to recognize that as we try to put good policy in place, and remember on the backside how this is going to be implemented. So those are some of the goals that I have.
Anna? Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for welcoming us so warmly this morning and getting us off on the right foot. And my name is Anna Wills. I'm the state representative for Apple Valley, Rosemount, and Coates. It's District 57B. And I represent just one school district because it's so large. It's the fourth largest district in the state, and it's Independent School District 196. So I've been working with them over the last couple of years and meeting with principals and teachers and our superintendent to work together to find out what's working and not working for them so I can be the best advocate for them here in the legislature. And some of the things that I'm hoping to focus on over the next couple of years, which is what I've been hearing from the teachers and the superintendent in my district, are focusing on reducing the unfunded mandates, whether that's actually providing funding to meet those requirements or reducing the requirement themselves. So looking specifically at special education, it's been an area that has been increasing in costs and paperwork burdens for the teachers. And as Representative Bennett mentioned about you get buried in the paperwork and you don't have as much time with the kids. So that's an area that I want to focus on. And then also streamlining the pipeline between high school and college is something that Representative Seltzer and I both have a passion for. So hoping to work together to provide opportunities and make it more flexible for college and the schools and PSEO and different programs like that. So looking forward to working with all of you and excited to be on this committee. Drew?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your hospitality this morning. I'm Drew Christensen. I represent Savage and Northwest Burnsville, which is the school districts of Burnsville, Prior Lake, and a little bit of the Shakopee School District. I'm excited to work together with everyone on this committee to make sure every kid gets a world-class education in Minnesota.
Abigail?
Good morning, Madam Chair, and thank you for all the coffee and goodies. It's wonderful. I am Abigail Whalen. I represent District 35A, Anoka and Ramsey, and the school districts of Anoka, Hennepin, and a little bit of ISD 728. My goals would be mostly to learn a lot and hopefully as well increase local control, and echoing some of the other sentiments of other representatives here, and I also would like to see, as Representative Wills mentioned, a reduction in unfunded mandates.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and echoing thank you for the goodies, but I say that with mixed emotions because you've set a standard for other committee chairs who haven't had their first committee yet. I represent school districts of Hutchinson, Nassau, Cokato, Eden Valley, Watkins, Litchfield, and of course one of the very stellar ones, Atwater Cosmos Grove City. Aren't you left? Actually, they have, that school district has done extremely well, from being from a failing school to now one of the top school systems in the state academically. I was a teacher for 35 years at New London Spicer, spending most of that time with seventh graders, so I'm well prepared for the legislature. And I have a wide assortment of interest, obviously, in education. You'll probably hear me talking a lot about these things this year, but a lot of the legislation that I'm working on focuses on maintaining and sustaining the high caliber of teachers that we have in Minnesota.
Here. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the coffee. I represent the District 30B, which is Northeast Wright County. It includes the cities of Albertville, St. Michael, Otsego, Hanover, and the Wright County side of Dayton, which is where I'm from. This is a very important issue in my district. In fact, when I was door knocking during the campaign, equity in education funding was the number one issue, is the number one issue in my district, because I have several school districts that are near the bottom of per pupil funding in the state. So I am honored to be on this committee. My background does include being a teacher. I've been teaching college for the last 7 years. I teach STEM courses, computer security, computer forensics, voice and data communications, and other things. So STEM courses and what we can do in that area in terms of innovation is also a priority for me. Thank you.
Niels?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your hospitality. It's been a wonderful morning so far for my very first committee, and this is exciting to be here. My name is Nels Pearson. I live in Rochester, Minnesota, and my district encompasses a large part of Olmsted County, including the school districts of Stuartville, Dover, Eota, and portions of Chatfield, Minnesota. I was a seven-year member of the FFA, and so vocation and agriculture, and I think in a lot of ways the many of the sentiments that have been shared here this morning I'd echo those to a large degree. I don't believe that one size fits all in our state. I think that that's important, and I think it's important to grant local school districts a lot more control as they know their needs better than we do, and they know how to create solutions that work for the people that they serve within their local school districts. Thank you.
Roz?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the Breakfast of Champions. Mm-hmm. My name is Roz Peterson. I'm from House District 56B, which is Burnsville and Lakeville, and I've had the honor of serving as chair of our school board, which is ISD 194 Lakeville area. But I also represent 191, which is Burnsville, Egan, Savage, and also 196, which is Rabe, Rosemont, Apple Valley, Egan. So I echo a lot of the comments that have already been made for goals, but certainly leveraging technology so there can be more innovation, more local control, as has been echoed many times before, less bureaucracy and more family involvement. I'm excited to serve.
Ryan, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Good morning. Ryan Winkler. I represent parts of Golden Valley, St. Louis Park, Plymouth, and the entire community of Medicine Lake, which is District 46A. And thank you, Madam Chair, for the treats, which I was too late to enjoy.
Well,
but
you can
thank
still
you anyway.
Enjoy them.
And you asked for a goal. Well, I think it's a pretty straightforward goal, which is that we want every kid to be able to live up to their full potential, and we want to make Minnesota a policy leader that allows us to lead in that direction.
David?
I represent 20B, which is Northfield, Lonsdale, Montgomery, roughly northern Rice County and eastern Le Sueur County. And I was a public school teacher for 30 years and have an interest in education and making sure, as Representative Winkler said, that all students are prepared to make the best use of the gifts that they have.
Thank you. And then we have partisan research. Will you begin, Gabrielle?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gabrielle Haughey, and I am the Republican Caucus researcher. And prior to holding this position, I was a legislative assistant with the House for 4 years.
And DFL?
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair, for the treats. It's a great way to start off the committee. My name is Jessica Nyman, and I am with the House DFL Caucus Research.
And just one next meeting, I'll have the those who represent education organizations introduce themselves. But we do have a department here today. So, Adosh, would you introduce yourself, please? And then finally, our star of the program today, nonpartisan House researcher Lisa Larson. Would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Lisa Larson. I work for House Research. I serve as the counsel to the Education Committee. I've worked for the House for more than 30 years and have had the privilege of serving both the current chair and the previous chair and many other members. And I find that working for this place is truly the ultimate privilege.
Thank you. And then to my left and to my right, my committee administrator, I almost forgot about these two important people. Carmen Mayo, would you say a little bit about yourself?
I'm Carmen Mayo. I'm the committee administrator for this committee. I am excited to do this. This I can go around with Chair Erickson, and this will be my 13th session here.
And Ethan Hellier.
I'm the CLA here. I grew up in School District 194. Ross Peterson is my current state rep, and this is my first time working here. I've only done campaign work, so it's going to be fun to be here and do some policy.
Thank you very much. And my office is 479, so please know that my door is open, and please share your ideas often. And GOPers, don't forget that we're having lunch this noon. But there will not be food provided for me other than leftovers. So bring your lunches. And so with that, let's move to Lisa Larson's PowerPoint presentation on No Child Left Behind. This is an important historical piece for us to understand. And Lisa has taken the time to prepare a PowerPoint. This will give us some background, and in light of the fact that in the Congress there's discussion about this enormous piece of legislation that has been around for decades but became known as No Child Left Behind under the George W. Bush administration because it added the accountability piece, is now perhaps in limbo, so we may have some after effects, but we want to get a good understanding of what it is and how we fit into it. So welcome, Elisa, to our committee, and please say your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Lisa Larson. I'd like to begin by just saying this is a little bit of an intimidating presentation to begin with, because I suspect everybody sitting in this room is very familiar with No Child Left Behind and may have some opinions, some even strongly held, about this particular law. So my purpose really today is not so much to provide you information that you don't have as to try to put it all in context. Oftentimes when legislators are new, it's hard to fully capture all that has preceded you, if only because it's one world of many worlds and you are very busy people. So what I want to do is kind of tell you about the act and specifically in the context of Minnesota accountability measures, and talk about how both federal and state expectations are intertwined, how the accountability systems are intertwined, and some of the issues that have arisen as a result of it. As Representative Erickson stated, President Johnson signed the first ESEA law, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, in 1965. Many people argue that it was part of his civil rights initiative. It was seen as an opportunity to make education access as a national goal. The 1994 ESEA was more modest in its aspirations than subsequent reauthorizations. It did direct states to adopt challenging curriculum content, performance standards, align assessments with state content standards, which is an issue still today, to implement an accountability system that would measure school and district progress toward improving student achievement. Now, you can say, why is the federal government so persuasive in this area? Well, one reason why it's persuasive has to do with money, just to be blunt about it. Title I under the ESEA is the single largest source of education funding. Title I funds are distributed based upon the number of low-income families that reside in a particular school district. And funds from Title I are used to provide additional education programs and help children who are behind in school. The ESEA was reauthorized in 2001. It was known as the No Child Left Behind Act, and it augmented what had been in the 1994 Act. It included additional federal assessment and accountability requirements that were intended to extend through 2008 because there was an expectation that Congress would reauthorize the law in 2007. It also established progressively severe consequences for schools that fail to improve test scores. Minnesota was not waiting for the federal government to enter into the arena of student accountability. In fact, Minnesota was working on a uniform statewide system of accountability before No Child Left Behind was reauthorized in 2001. In fact, in 1992, the legislature directed what was then the State Board of Education, and by the by, Minnesota, I think, is one of very few states in the entire country without a State Board of Education currently. But the legislature in 1992 directed the State Board of Education to develop a graduation rule that would focus both on minimum competencies and rigorous standards. And there has always been a tension between ensuring that whatever the state decrees as the floor in terms of academic preparation, students can meet, while at the same time encouraging students to achieve rigorous academic expectations. The first foray after 1992 was something called outcome-based education. And I recall that there were dozens upon dozens of these outcomes. There was one I recall thinking about calling it the Arnold Toynbee candy striper outcome. And basically, you were supposed to know everything about the world and be a good person, too. And those outcomes proved unworkable. And as a consequence, ultimately, we ended up with something called the Rigorous Results-Oriented Graduation Rule, and it was implemented beginning in 1996-97. That rule had two components consistent with the desire for establishing both minimum competencies as well as incentives for rigorous coursework. So we had the basic skills tests in reading, math, and writing, and then something called the profiled learning, which you may recall was a subject of much controversy over the course of certainly the last half of the 1990s. The grade 8 basic skills tests were designed to assess minimum competencies. They did not assess progress toward high standards, and for that reason could not meet federal accountability requirements. Also, if students failed the basic skills tests in eighth grade, they had multiple chances to retake those basic skills tests in order to pass them by the time they graduated.
The profile of learning used performance assessments to measure students' progress toward achieving academic excellence. These were not standards-based requirements, unlike the MCAs, which are standards-based. The profile of learning tested students on their ability to demonstrate the acquiring of content standards in 24 learning areas. In 1998, before the 2001 reauthorization of No Child Left Behind, Minnesota's educational accountability system was not premised on annual testing, but on annual tests in grades 3, 5, and then 7. The MCAs, the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, were developed for this system. Reading and math MCAs were first administered in grades 3 and 5 in 1998, and in grade 7 in 2001. The grade 7 test became operational in 2004. High school students under the profile of learning were tested on content standards and required learning areas. In 2003, after several attempts, the legislature repealed the profile of learning and new reading and math content standards were adopted. Now, there has been a lot of debate about the value of No Child Left Behind, but I think there is general consensus, at least in one regard, and that was that No Child Left Behind obligated states and local districts to focus on the academic achievement gap, so that it was possible, based upon the student performance data on standardized tests that the No Child Left Behind required, to highlight the performance of different groups of students. And if I can just editorialize for 1 minute, at the beginning of this law, these groups of students were called subgroups. And even the nomenclature was really problematic, in my opinion. So rather than call them subgroups, which is how they were referred to in law, I prefer just to talk about groups of students. Anyway, No Child Left Behind singled out groups of students to pay attention to in terms of how their academic performance compared to students generally. English learners, students with disabilities, students who were eligible for free and reduced price meals, and white, black, Asian Pacific Islander, American Indian, and Hispanic students. And the point was to look at the outcomes for all these individual groups of students and improve them, because when we created averages, as we had done, it was easy to mask how well or how poorly some student groups were doing. The federal school improvement requirements applied to high poverty schools that were eligible to receive Title I funds. The federal government required states to align academic content and student performance standards. Under the federal law, districts and schools were required to annually assess students' progress in achieving the standards. And the students' performance on the test would show whether or not schools were making adequate yearly progress, AYP, toward proficiency. And the whole goal here was that by 2013-2014, and remember, reauthorization was supposed to occur by 2008, but by 2013-2014, all children in every school and every district would be proficient in reading and math. And proficient means reach a point of demonstrated performance. In addition, the federal law required students to take science tests one time in three different grade spans, 3 to 5, 6 to 9, and 10 to 12. But the performance on the science tests were not part of the adequate yearly progress measure. In addition, the federal law required a sample of students to take the biennial National Assessment of Educational Progress reading and math test called NAEP. And you may hear NAEP talked about from time to time. The value of NAEP is that it's the only instrument currently available to make cross-state comparisons. The Title I schools under this regimen suffered increasingly severe consequences each year they did not make adequate yearly progress, and realized that these were the schools with larger at-risk populations, particularly poor, and to the extent there's a correlation between poor and other characteristics, these are the schools we're talking about. Consequences for these schools ranged from having to bus students to different schools within a district that were making adequate yearly progress, taking Title I funds to provide before and after school tutoring programs, all the way to the obligation to reassign or dismiss staff. One of the provisions required a state takeover of a school, although Minnesota law never provided for that option, and closing schools. Schools would fail to make adequate yearly progress if they did not meet or keep or sustain specific levels of performance for students as the entire group of students, and then for each group, the federal law said subgroup, of students. So that if all the students did not make adequate yearly progress, or any one group of students didn't make adequate yearly progress, then the school or the district failed to make adequate yearly progress. So the way the system worked, if a school had fewer as opposed to more identified student groups in its student population, there were fewer chances for a school to fail. So the more diverse the population, assuming that there were a critical number of kids, because under 20 or 40 kids, the data wasn't recorded for two reasons. It wasn't reliable, and we didn't want to identify the kids. But the more diverse the population of students, the more chances the school had, in theory, to fail to make adequate yearly progress. Under the federal law, states were allowed to establish their own academic goals, use state-developed tests to assess students' mastery of those goals, and also define proficiency for purposes of state tests and measuring adequate yearly progress. Minnesota's Title I plan defined as proficient those students who achieved a score of 1420 on the MCAs, and there had been a plan to up that score to, I think, about 1500. Minnesota's Title I plan included several indicators as part of adequate yearly progress. Student performance, what kind of score kids got on these tests, math and reading tests, student attendance, and also high school graduation rate. So you think about these three criteria, and then you think about the number of groups each school was responsible or was obligated to report, and you can see how difficult it became to, in fact, succeed at achieving adequate yearly progress year upon year. The federal law required all states and school districts throughout the country to institute a couple of specific measures. One of them included report cards, and a faculty member at the University of Minnesota who has been very, very helpful to the legislature over many years in establishing, in helping to write some of our accountability language, said that the best form of accountability is public reporting. And the report cards are that measure of public reporting, but what becomes or can be problematic is what is measured in fact useful, and is what is measured helping to advance whatever goals the federal government or the state had in mind. So one of the requirements was that states and local school districts publicly report school scores for statewide testing. And that's an important distinction, because originally the law was structured to impose the burden on schools. But then the question becomes, well, what makes this important to students? And what made this important to students was high-stakes testing. Another measure that the federal government required were that teacher teachers and paraprofessionals be highly qualified. This was not such a difficult proposition in Minnesota because most of Minnesota's teachers, in fact, met the definition of highly qualified. And that definition meant that teachers needed, at a minimum, to have a bachelor's degree and pass a state subject area test. There was also a requirement for highly qualified paraprofessionals, and highly qualified paraprofessionals had to have meet one of three criteria: 2 years of college, an associate degree, or sufficient knowledge and teaching ability as demonstrated by an instrument. In addition, under the federal law, disadvantaged schools were eligible to receive funding for research-based teaching programs and teacher training, and schools in high poverty areas were eligible to receive grants for reading programs. In Minnesota, Minnesota legislature directed the Department of Education in 2001 to use, quote, highly reliable statewide or district assessments to measure a couple of things: the adequate yearly progress of all schools, not just Title I schools, school performance, and the progress of individual students. The Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments were administered for accountability purposes for the first time in 2004. At that point, grade 10 students took the MCA reading test, and grade 11 students took the MCA math test. Minnesota expanded its assessment system in 2005-2006 school year, and this leads us to annual testing for accountability purposes. Students in grades 3 through 8, 10 and 11 were assessed with MCAs in reading and math. And I'm not discussing the writing test, which is separate. Testing information was used to determine school and district proficiency levels, you know, how well students were performing on the test at a point at a defined score, and also whether enough students in each group and students generally were making adequate progress toward 100% proficiency. Minnesota assessed school progress based on proficiency, test participation rates for all schools, high school graduation rates, and elementary and middle school attendance rates. And so if you think about it, the accountability for all students' groups identified under the federal law, combined with all of these performance measures, made it very difficult for many schools to demonstrate adequate yearly progress. And as a matter of fact, I think in about 2005, the legislative auditor did a report on the No Child Left Behind Act. And I'm paraphrasing this glibly, but essentially said, if you keep up this pace, practically every state in the practically every school in the state will be failing by the time we get to the 2013-2014 school year. The federal focus was on whether or not students met a statewide proficiency standard at a given point in time. Originally, the law did not allow for value-added assessments, which is a topic that has been debated here in the legislature for a period of time. Value-added assessments are one way of evaluating academic growth of individual students over time. The federal law also initially did not allow measures of student growth or on and off-grade testing. As a matter of fact, when the legislature first proposed growth and passed it, that the first time it passed, I believe there was a veto. There were also a legislator here a number of years ago proposed a computer adaptive test for on and off grade testing. Well, the federal law said only on grade testing, because we need to know how proficient students are for that particular grade level. So rather than measure students' performance, some students might be performing above grade level, others below grade level, and to learn how well they were performing, the states were restricted in measuring only on-grade performance. This is changing now, but it was part of the evolution of this federal law. Adequate yearly progress, as it was originally envisioned, was based solely on performance. The proportion of students who were proficient at a particular score as defined by the state. Schools that failed to make adequate yearly progress for two or more consecutive years had to prepare improvement plans, and there were increasingly severe consequences, as we mentioned previously, applied to schools that persistently failed to make adequate yearly progress. So the schools with high proportions of student groups were experiencing more and more consequences the more time they could not demonstrate adequate yearly progress. And this was progressive. Then we had a slight recession. During this recession, the federal government proposed something called the race to the top. And during the recession, the $4 billion in competitive education grants looked very good to a lot of states. It was part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The point of these grants was to create state education reform. So Minnesota, 39 other states, and the District of Columbia applied for grants in January of 2010. And I thought it would be interesting for you to know what was in the grant, in the grant proposal, in the application that Minnesota submitted to the federal government. And if I could digress for a second, this is the comment I'm about to make is from the standpoint of someone who a staff person from the legislature. And I know that this is not the same perspective you would get from the executive branch, but since I'm a legislative staff person, I thought I'd make this point. It would seem from the legislative standpoint that the way this federal program is set up to operate, it does not really require the input of elected officials. So that when the state plan was originally developed, it was developed by the executive branch without input from the legislature, no input required. And when this grant program application was developed, it really wasn't a matter of a significant amount of input from the legislative branch. And I only mention this to you because my opinion is there's a lot at stake for elected officials in this discussion. So back to what the content of Minnesota's Race to the Top application included. The first thing, adopt a common set of nationwide core K-12 standards in English, language, arts, and math. Does that sound familiar? And build toward college and career readiness. Also, participate in a consortium working to develop high-quality assessments aligned with these standards. Minnesota did not do this, but it certainly had the opportunity to do it. And I should just mention, you may well be aware that Minnesota's English language arts standards are consistent with the Common Core, but Minnesota's math standards are not. And that, as a matter of fact, was a result of testimony that the legislature received from the chair of the math department at the University of Minnesota, a fellow by the name of Professor Larry Gray, who worked on both the state and federal math standards. And he and the teacher of the year, a math teacher by the name of Ellen Delaney, testified before the legislature and said the math standards in Minnesota were better. And that's, at least to my recollection, certainly one of the principal reasons why Minnesota has its own math standards and not the Common Core standards. Just to suggest to you that the role of the legislature is significant, too. Okay, more about Race to the Top application. Included in the Minnesota's application was a representation to have the State Board of Teaching and the State Board of School Administrators amend their rules to support alternative licensure programs that would be consistent with the Race to the Top guidelines and to adopt a three-tier licensure structure. The application said it would, Minnesota would implement a teacher and principal evaluation system that would use student growth data as a significant factor to make employment-related decisions. Minnesota would implement a QCOMP plan that, among other things, would include principals, require peer assistance, grant tenure to effective teachers based on evaluation outcomes, use individual, class, and school-level student growth data to evaluate teachers, and use school-level student growth data to evaluate both teachers and principals. There's still more. The application suggested Minnesota would use both financial and non-financial incentives to give greater flexibility to place and retain highly effective teachers and principals in high-need schools and subject areas throughout the state. It would have the State Board of Teaching amend its rules so that teacher preparation programs with 20 or more graduates would provide the state with student proficiency and growth data and other data related to program graduates. And this has to do with a proposal for greater accountability for teacher preparation programs. And finally, there was a proposal to use an Office of Turnaround Schools separate from the department and a law that I don't think has ever been implemented, but at that time had been newly enacted, site-governed schools model, to intervene in the persistently lowest-achieving schools and in districts in improvement or corrective action status. Minnesota did not receive a Race to the Top grant, and some experts have suggested that at the end of the day, states may have been better off not receiving a grant, because if you look at the comprehensive nature of this proposal, the tens of millions of dollars that would have been available for the grant program arguably was simply not sufficient either to implement or sustain all of these initiatives. Okay, to the consequences of the No Child Left Behind Act. The law was expected to have been reauthorized in 2007-2008. It was not. So after 10 years, in 2010-2011, about half of all schools in the country were not making adequate yearly progress. These data trends led to questions about whether schools could even succeed under the federal framework. There were many unintended consequences. They included narrowing the curriculum to focus on tested subject areas, placing greater weight on core curriculum to the exclusion of other subject areas and skills areas, and causing teachers to teach to the test. In addition, the federal data required didn't provide diagnostic and predictive information. So there were a lot of districts taking time and money and personnel resources to give students other tests that would provide this kind of diagnostic and predictive information that could help inform curriculum and instruction. One thing that I have learned in listening to testimony about testing over time is that one test cannot be all things to all people. And so if you have a summative test, it can provide you with certain kinds of information, but it can't necessarily provide you with all kinds of information, and it may not even be providing you with information that you might consider most useful, at least in immediate terms. Many superintendents, and the legislative auditor did a report on this, so in fact, this quote is from from the legislative auditor's report. Many school superintendents believe that the act was costly, unrealistic, and punitive. School superintendents were concerned about a number of things. Was it reasonable to hold students with disabilities and English learners to the same standards as other students. And this question really was not about the equity of the whole thing. It was because of the impact on schools' ability to make adequate yearly progress as defined by the Act. So you might ask, is this the outcome? Is this a perverse outcome? Is this a helpful outcome? But this was the concern of many school officials. They were also concerned about additional local costs that were required for these student assessments, particularly if they were not providing kinds of information that schools and districts were putting a premium on, diagnostic and predictive information. The administrators were concerned about the sanctions that were facing low-performing schools, and this was not so much an issue in Minnesota, but was certainly an issue nationwide, and what the difficulties were in complying with stricter standards for staff qualifications. And if you think about this in the context of too few teachers available in particular areas, even if you have highly qualified staff, that's yet another wrinkle to this concern. And that, just as an aside to kind of illustrate the perverse outcomes, I imagine you all heard about what happened in the Atlantic public schools with educators who confessed to cheating when administering the Georgia statewide competency test. I don't think we start with the premise that educators are dishonest or in any way want to beat the system, so it kind of begs the question, how did we get to this point? And finally, to the waiver. In 2011, the federal government decided to allow states to apply for a federal waiver from certain federal requirements. So if states agree to undertake certain kinds of reforms, the federal government would allow states to avoid the goal of universal proficiency by 2014, which seemed to be couldn't be realized, and also the consequences of failing to meet adequate yearly progress. Under the proposal, states would be able to design their own accountability systems and combine test scores with other measures, so now perhaps growth, other kinds of measures, rather than just rely on test score data. However, states would be required to incorporate college and career-ready expectations for all students, and I believe on Thursday, Representative Erickson asked that career and college readiness be one of the topics that we discuss. And then one other aspect which has generated a lot of controversy, and the feds have gone back and forth on this, states perhaps would not need to emphasize the performance of at-risk groups of students. However, civil rights groups, disability advocates, business representatives see emphasizing the performances of at-risk groups of students as absolutely crucial for holding schools accountable for vulnerable groups of students and also for providing educational equity and opportunity. So this is one of the terrible tensions in how this law does or does not operate. In 2012, Minnesota was granted a two-year waiver after it agreed to certain federal reforms. It would implement career and college-ready standards. And by the by, if I can digress just for a second, the feds call it college and career-ready, but Minnesota's law says career and college-ready, and is quite deliberate. First of all, applied learning, experiential learning, career focus became the sorry stepchild of the education system for a long time. And the ultimate goal for all students at the end of the day, in addition to becoming civic members of the community and civically engaged, is to achieve a career of some kind. And college takes many different forms. So Minnesota says career for all, and then college in its many forms. So Minnesota agreed to implement college, career, and college-ready standards and corresponding assessments to measure both student achievement and student growth, which means progress over time. Minnesota would recognize high-achieving and high-growth schools and also support chronically low-achieving schools. It would use both teacher and principal evaluations to improve instruction and make student performance data a significant factor in evaluating teachers. And finally, it would seek to reduce duplication and other kinds of burdens. So, with the waiver, Minnesota schools do no longer need to provide supplemental education or transportation services for inter-district transfers. They are not being sanctioned for failing to make adequate yearly progress, and they have greater flexibility to allocate Title I funds. Minnesota's waiver replaces that original federal goal of achieving 100% student proficiency in reading and math by 2014 with a different goal. This goal is to reduce Minnesota's student achievement gap between all students and historically underperforming groups of students by 50% by 2017. The AYP measure under the waiver is replaced with something called the MMR, and I think you may hear the department, given the context, talk about the multiple measures rating. This is the MMR. It's based on student academic proficiency and growth measures, student success in reducing the achievement gap for specific groups of students, and student graduation rates. Minnesota's waiver was extended a third year through the 2015 school year, and may be extended again. Here's an important point that I'd like to make. The MMR ratings that are used to measure student performance and growth are distinct from educational accountability measures in Minnesota statutes, the measures enacted by the legislature. Minnesota accountability measures include completing of coursework, the extent of rigorous course taking, and student engagement and connection at school. The waiver is a document prepared by the executive branch to satisfy the requirements of federal accountability. That's not to say that they are good, bad, or indifferent. It's just important to understand that they are part of the federal waiver. It is certainly the prerogative of the legislature to consider them part of the statewide accountability system, but they are not currently in statute. So when you think about these measures and you think about accountability, my advice would be, please be deliberate about the kinds of measures that you think you would like incorporated into a statewide system of accountability. And then, just to show you that this tension on equity is never ending, originally there was an anticipation that making a state plan for the equitable distribution of effective teachers would be part of the waiver, the newest waiver application. But in fact, it's not. And now the state plan, I think, has to be submitted by June, and that means that's after the waiver application and perhaps after the legislature is adjourned. You are going to hear about a number of school designations in the course of discussion about accountability. So under Minnesota's waiver, please know that schools that receive Title I and school improvement grant funds receive a school designation. You will hear about priority schools. They are the bottom 5% of the most persistently low-performing schools. Focus schools, they are the 10% of schools with the largest student achievement gap and high school graduation rates with under 60%. And then continuous improvement schools, which are the bottom 25% of lowest performing schools, and this would include most priority and focus schools. Priority, focus, and continuous improvement schools are required to develop a school turnaround or improvement plan and set aside 20% of their Title I funds to implement the plan. In addition, there are celebration schools. These are the 10% of schools with MMR ratings between the 60th and 85th percentile in their category of school, and reward schools, which are the top 15% of highest performing schools. Okay, and finally, if the U.S. Congress reauthorizes No Child Left Behind before the waiver period ends, the reauthorization may affect the status of the waiver. It's impossible to know. Current speculation seems to be changing daily. It suggests that a reauthorized No Child Left Behind Act may scale back the federal role in K-12 education, may reduce the number of required tests, although Secretary Duncan says no. If this is an option pursued, it may result in testing in certain grades, which is what Minnesota did at one time. Or, most recently, there was even conversation about perhaps changing the kinds of tests required, but keeping annual testing. And to show you that not only is the substance of this complicated, but so are the politics. So various education stakeholders, for example, have conflicting interests related to statewide testing. For example, think about civil rights groups and teacher groups. Is testing a crucial element of accountability, or is it a distraction from teaching and learning?
Thank you very much, Ms. Larson. Are there questions from members for which you need clarification? No political questions, please, but clarification. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for getting us started in this session by focusing on NCLB, which really does cast a large shadow over the work that we do in the state. In my opinion, it's a mixed bag. Sometimes I think it's a very compelling and powerful shadow, but sometimes it could be a very problematic one. And obviously, as state legislators, one of the things, regardless of what policy area we're in, we're constantly wrestling with the responsibility and the duty that we have as state legislators to legislate on behalf of our constituents and our people according to our values and our principles and our that we hold in our state, and balancing that against Congress's similar efforts. There's a lot here, and I guess I would encourage members, individual members, particularly those who are new to the NCLB history and framework, to avail themselves. I'm sorry, Lisa, I'm going to do this to you. To avail themselves of Lisa, because there really is a lot here. We have lived, and you and I, Madam Chair, have lived and breathed this for the last decade. And it's been quite a struggle, quite a journey. But there's also been great opportunities for us to find some sweet spots in between federal and state law. I just want to ask a very specific question for you, Ms. Larson. Earlier, you spoke about consequences of NCLB, and you asserted that there were narrowing of curriculum and a greater weight on core curriculum to exclusion of other subject areas. I actually believe that. But my question really is, you know, objectively, is can we point to quantitative information and studies that, in fact, support those conclusions?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I don't know the answer to your question, but we could certainly see what the literature out there says. There are a lot of experts asserting this. What basis they rely on to make these assertions, we could examine.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Ms. Larson, and many of those experts are classroom teachers and principals and superintendents, and I have certainly heard from them, and their insights have greatly guided the work that we've done over the last few years, particularly on this issue of the strong possibility that federal law has had a restrictive nature on student experiences relative to to education. But I just wanted to, and probably it's something, Madam Chair, that, quite frankly, we ought to consider having perhaps our legislative auditor do some kind of a review of what the impact has been, if any, on experiences for students to or opportunities for students to experience a diverse curriculum, and whether or not NCLB has restricted that, and also whether it's restricted our schools' ability to structure those opportunities for students.
And Representative Mariani, you know, we will be submitting suggestions for audit. So keep keep that one in mind, because it would be about, I think, the right time to follow up on the previous audit that was delivered. Are there other clarifying questions? Representative Whelan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, if it hasn't been reauthorized, how or why are we still operating under NCLB?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, the law continues in effect mm-hmm. until it is reauthorized. And that's why the waivers exist, because the law is unchanged until Congress acts. But Secretary Duncan has a lot of authority under the law to issue waivers. There is considerable authority in the law itself that allows for the waivers. And that's the alternative to Congress acting.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Larson. Just so that I understand some of the terminology here, is Common Core part of No Child Left Behind?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, it was part of a number of states' applications. It was encouraged by the Race to the Top program, and quite a number of states agreed to it in order to pursue the grants. And there was also a lot of interest at the federal level among governors' groups and so forth in encouraging states to adopt the Common Core.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Larson, then, regarding the testing, it's my understanding that, you know, at one time Minnesota sought a waiver to get away from the MCAs and implement another form of testing, and that was denied. Are we testing at more levels than are required?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, as part of career and college readiness, as part of concern for making tests useful, in recognition of the fact that many districts already, on their own initiative, at their own expense, using their own resources, administer more formative tests. In 2013, the legislature enacted changes to Minnesota's testing system. I think the legislature and intended ultimately to make career and college readiness the underlying principle for the testing regimen. So there was a hope that with the new suite of assessments that were diagnostic and predictive, that ultimately it would be possible to use that suite of assessments to satisfy federal accountability requirements. And in the 2013 legislation, there is direction to the Commissioner of Education in consultation with the Chancellor to begin to look at alignment. I believe the department did look at alignment between the suite of career and college ready suite of assessments, and concluded that alignment did not exist between the assessment and the standards. And at that point, I think that the pursuit of what the law envisioned may have stopped.
Representative Erdahl, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Larson. So then, are Minnesota schools testing more than is required?
Ms. Larson, I don't know if you can answer that, but...
Well, Madam Chair, members, Representative Erdahl, I could say this to you. There are federal testing requirements, there are state testing requirements, and then the districts are giving students tests in order to better inform curriculum and instruction. So there are requirements, and part of the tension here is, what about the federal law as it impacts whatever it is that the state would like to accomplish in terms of its statewide accountability system? That's what this this discussion is in large part about.
Well, members, I began my teaching career in 1964, And then along came the Elementary Secondary Educational Act, and we had it kind of quiet on the front for a decade or so, and I know I can look around and see members who probably can relate to this. And then when the 90s began, that's when, well, actually the 70s too, but the 90s, as Ms. Larson has pointed out in her PowerPoint, that's when there was a more discussion at the federal level of moving toward more accountability. And under President Clinton, I know there were some changes, but it was really under the George W. Bush administration that the testing really became the piece of accountability. And in my district, we used to dread the visits by the department. Just because they were time-consuming, not that we didn't respect the department folks who came out to visit. And remember, this was under a variety of administrations, so whether Democrat or Republican, that was beside the point. It was the department coming out to give us a foretaste of what was to come. And we thought, well, this too shall pass until, of course, No Child Left Behind. And the basic skills test, which is really the only testing I experienced in full in my career because I retired in 2000. But thank you, Ms. Larson, for imparting this history to us and the detail that you have given us. And I think, members, it helps us understand the impact that the race to the top also had in moving Minnesota in a certain direction. And remember, that was under a previous administration, and then that blended into the Dayton administration days. So we have seen these changes under both political parties, and that's true at the national and at the state level. And we're the ones who need to grapple with this, as was mentioned at the onset from Ms. Larson. You know, legislators were kind of kept at bay until we started getting more vocal during the Profile of Learning, and Representative Mariani could tell you about our floor debates on repealing the Profile of Learning, which became quite amusing over a few years, and finally we got rid of it, feeling that it had dumbed down. But my last comment is in regard to yours, Representative Erdahl. You know, more testing really came about because we teachers felt that we needed to do more to prove, you know, that our students were able to test at the proficiency level. For me, it started with basic skills, and then it moved into the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments. So I think that, you know, testing has become such an issue because we have felt that need to find ways to ensure that in the end our students will prove that they have learned under our teaching. So it goes, and this will become kind of a basis for what comes ahead of us. Thank you again, Ms. Larson, very much, and we look forward to Thursday's presentation. Members, we have in the audience a few more FFAers. If you would stand and introduce yourselves and give the school from which you come. We'll start over here in the top row.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Sam Johnson. I'm a freshman at South Dakota State University and am originally from Glenville, Minnesota.
Good morning. I'm Brady Wolf. I'm also a freshman at South Dakota State University, and I attended high school in Morris, Minnesota, and I'm serving as this year's state FFA trip.
And a couple rows down.
Good morning. My name is Thomas Horning. I'm a senior at Hutchinson High School.
Good morning. My name is Michelle Sauber, and I'm a sophomore at St.
And thank you very much, young people, for joining us. I know that you had an event yesterday, and you're continuing over the next couple of days to come together and really help us understand the importance of your program. And hopefully we can find ways to support your good work that you're doing in your classrooms that leads you into college and to success, or into careers and success. So thank you for being here.
At this point, I'd like to ask the Board of Teaching Executive Director to come to the table, introduce herself, and if you want to bring your specialist with you, and just give us an overview, Ms. Doan, of the Board of Teaching. This is a separate entity. We think of it as an ad hoc agency in a sense, but Ms. Doan will explain what the Board of Teaching is. And because we've seen so much reference to teachers in our No Child Left Behind presentation, I think it would be good to hear from you in explaining what the Board of Teaching is. So introduce yourself for the record, and then when your specialist is ready, do the same. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Erin Doan, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Teaching. Actually, let's do introductions now. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Alex Lietze. I'm a teacher education specialist with the Board of Teaching.
Please proceed.
Thank you. I think it's a great thing to be able to have the opportunity to provide clarity early on in session. I think it's one of the many mysteries of Minnesota's education system. What is the difference between the Minnesota Board of Teaching and the Department of Education? Aren't they the same thing? They live in the same house. So thank you for this opportunity again. The Board of Teaching is a professional standards board, and as Madam Chair referenced earlier, is a standalone entity in the state. While the Board of Teaching has purview over teacher ethics and over licensure policy, the Board of Teaching does not implement licensure policy directly. So we rely on educator licensing at the Department of Education to be able to take those policies and carry them out through the application process and to work with schools and districts directly. That is not to say that the Board of Teaching does not hear from districts, partner with districts, collaborate with districts on a day-to-day basis, but certainly the nuts and bolts of what happens in an application process are carried out by the department directly. Going forward, I think there have been a number of issues that have been highly controversial in the last few years, particularly regarding teacher testing. And without going into great detail today, I think that will be one of the issues that you hear most from the Board of Teaching this session, is just proposing a number of changes to the way we look at basic skills testing for teachers as compared to the basic skills test we were talking about for students prior. In addition, the other issue that we've heard a lot from constituents about over the last year especially would be those candidates who are coming from other states to Minnesota, and what we can do to make sure that we're honoring the hard work and the licensure that's coming from training programs from other states while upholding Minnesota standards and helping to better communicate with candidates what Minnesota's expectations are and how teachers can move into the profession more seamlessly, especially in shortage areas. With that, I will leave off for today, but certainly welcome any questions you might have. Thank you.
And could we have an explanation of what your duties are as a teacher's a specialist for the board, please?
Yes, and many duties. Most recently, it's institution approval and program approval. So we're looking at the materials that institutions do in teacher education programs and that they have, they present to us, and we decide if they... how they're preparing their teachers, and if that is what we as a state, if it's meeting the standards that the Board of Teaching has set for what we want teachers to have in the teacher education programs.
And would you tell us how many teacher preparation programs we have in the state, and how many come up for review every year?
There are 32 teacher education institutions. We have about 4 or 5 institutions that we look at per year. And the programs themselves, though, are, I believe there's more than 600 programs, and those come up on a biannual review. We do 16 different institutions every other year.
And would you explain who does these evaluations or these reviews of each program?
Currently, there's 2 education specialists that do the reviews. If we have new programs that are up for review, we do external reviewers that are experts in the field that come and look at the programs.
And do Board of Teaching members continue to do the visits?
I have only been around for 3 months of the visits, but I have heard that, yes, Board of Teaching members are part of visits as much as possible.
Because, members, I'm a former member of the Board of Teaching, serving in the 90s. before I was elected to this position, and had the pleasure of visiting teacher preparation programs around the state to help with the evaluations, and spent a great deal of time visiting with students who were enrolled in the programs. And you learn a lot about teacher preparation programs when you listen and visit face-to-face with the candidates. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Doran, how many staff do you have?
Ms. Doan.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, we at this point have six, including myself, and that's, thank you for mentioning that. I also wanted to take the opportunity to thank all of you. Last year, you, those of you who were in conversation with me would have noticed that we were down to a very small number of staff as budget cuts had caught up with the Board of Teaching over time. As of October, we are back up to full six for staffing, but are relying on a one-year increase to our budget, and we'll be back asking for an increase to our budget permanently.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you feel that that is, six is adequate to meet the demands of the staff?
Ms. Doan.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, no. By Mr. Liuzzi's testimony earlier, we have two teacher education specialists that are responsible for 32 teacher preparation institutions, and actually he made a very good estimate, but really we're closer to 800 programs in the state right now. So while the Board of Teaching does due diligence, certainly we could use more hands on deck.
Are there other questions for Ms. Stone? Thank you. Thank you very much, and we look forward to working with you. Members know that House File 2 does focus on teaching effectively and teacher licensures, so sometime in the future we'll be hearing that bill, and we'll certainly be hearing from Ms. Doan and perhaps members of the Board of Teaching as well as others. We also have in the audience, Steve, would you stand up and introduce yourself from the department? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else from the department who is present? Or from the governor's staff? Thank you, because those are all a part of our executive and legislative branches. The rest, as I said in my opening comments, will get to introduce themselves on Thursday, because many sitting in this audience, as members know, are associated with an education organization or a budget item, and that's not directly related to our committee, but often policy has cost to it, and so I see the reading corps in the audience and others as well. So thank you very much for being here and continuing to support us and follow us. With that, members, let's take a look at the rules that have been created for this committee. It is a separate handout, and it would be good, members, if you keep that in your folders. You have a save file, so anything that you would like to save could be placed in the save file so that we don't have to continue to print these documents and cut down more trees, although I know that Representative Fabian would say we need to have the lumber industry or the tree growers active too. So members, the first 6 points are a basic procedure, and please know that we would appreciate knowing that you cannot attend so that you can be excused and not counted as absent. And Representative Ward, did you have a comment?
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
There, and this morning was an example of some slowdowns on 94 from the east. And I know from the previous 2 years that when weather is bad, it can take me over 2 hours to drive 9 miles. At which time it was helpful to have you've got phone numbers, but I'm assuming that I mean, on the website there are phone numbers, but I'm assuming that those are phones at your desks. Is there a mobile phone that we could text one of the assistants and let you know that I'm stuck in traffic, and I know other people have had these experiences as well. So if you could provide a text number for us, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Representative Ward. That is such an important question, and we will update these rules to include that. But yes, because most of us text, that would be excellent that you would alert us to the fact that you're stuck in traffic or for some other reason will be late. That was an excellent question, and perhaps you'll see an addendum or a revision of these rules. I thank Representative Mariani's staff for giving me the basis for these rules because I like them better than my rules 4 years ago. So appreciated what you had put down.
We have learned and taught each other.
Yes, we have. It is very good. And bill hearings, which will be coming up, please follow the process for that. Amendments, I think we have kept the same rules that you used, Representative Mariani, so we should be used to that. Minor oral amendments, as you see in number 9, will be accepted during hearings, and a written copy would be most appreciated to Carmen, to our CLA, during the hearing. And then per diem requests are also delineated there. Are there any other questions in regard to these rules? And we don't need to adopt them. We'll just provide you with maybe an amended set so that we can place a text number that will be visible to you. And we can also send out an email. With that, members, be sure that you help yourselves. And that goes for anyone in the audience, to any of the refreshments. We will have our next hearing on Thursday at 8:15 prompt. And with that, members, the meeting is adjourned.